Good evening. I'm going to call the Tax Conference Committee back to order for today. And I want to apologize to everyone who's been waiting. Senator Bach and I were in a meeting with Senator Pogemiller and Speaker Kelleher and trying to get some things done in negotiations. We are also going to be called away at about 9, and Senator Bach and I would like Senator Skoy and Representative Marquardt to lead the conference committee at that time through property tax items and try to get some things worked through, if that's okay with everybody. Yeah. We're hoping no money decisions, but right, Senator Bach, you okay with it?
I'm fine with the making money decisions.
Well, you know, the house isn't, but I think the property tax chairs just need to work through some stuff and make some decisions and get them done. I did want to say one thing, and that is, and the senators may not have even heard this, but House members were talked to today by the K-12 chair, Representative Greiling, that she is not sure, but she has heard there may be a move by some, I don't know if it's senators, I don't know who it is, to potentially ask this conference committee to carry K-12 provisions if the Senate does not pass a K-12 bill. We all here have given Representative Greiling our commitment that we will not do that. So I don't know what the Senate's position is going to be on this, but the House is going to stand firm and not try to do the K-12 bill in this tax conference committee. And so maybe none of you have even heard this, but we want to honor Representative Greiling and her committee's work. And if the Senate is not going to pass a K-12 bill, then that's how it goes. But we have 4 votes here at least to ensure that we're not going to undercut their work. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I think the position of the Senate would be that decision is probably above our pay grade. I wouldn't rule out that some provisions might end up in this bill that aren't contained in our book, and it wouldn't be a decision of mine and likely not of yours.
Well, and Senator Bach, it is true if our speaker works with Representative Greiling and she's agreed along with the speaker to make a change there, they'd be talking to us, but at this time, I just didn't want anyone who's watching or listening in the room to think that that is the intention here, because that rumor is swirling around, and I don't want to do the work of the K-12 committee. So we'll see. You're right. That could change, but hopefully not. So is there anything else anybody wanted to talk about first besides Green Acres? Whoops. I see we have a new conferee, Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I had asked Senator Olsen if he would sit in as a 6th conferee. I wouldn't expect him to have a vote, but if the committee would indulge us to have him participate in the discussion on Green Acres, there's a lot of those parcels of property in his district. This is important provision to him. And we really would like the House's consideration. The Senate had a vote on the floor and put a Green Acre provision in the bill that we'd like the House to consider. So that's what I know about that.
Okay. Anybody else have anything? If not, I think we're just going to start working on whatever Senator Skoy and Representative Marquardt want to. And Senator Bach and I will leave in a while and come back in a while. Representative Marquardt?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Here are some items that I think we're pretty close on. If we could go to side-by-side, page 18, it's House Article 1, Section 18. And this is the one dealing with township phone numbers on the tax statement. This is, should be on page 6. Article 1, Section 18 at the very bottom. Right now, the TNT statement says that township officers, on that part where it says who to contact regarding your property tax statement, they've got to have a phone number. Well, what's happened is some of them have received some harassing phone calls. Plus, when you get this form, they've already set their levy back in March, so they're no longer doing that. But they still would have to put some, like, PO box number or something. There'd still be some way to contact this person, just would not be the personal phone number of the township official. So this was brought to us by the Township Association.
Representative Marquardt, was this a bill? Was there a Senate bill on this? I don't remember hearing anything.
I don't know if there was
a Senate bill.
There's a House bill, but
House bill? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it seems relatively innocuous.
Well,
Senator Rest.
So what is available to a taxpayer? Who do they contact?
Well, there, Senator Rest, there still would be some contact, either an address to send a letter to. I mean, right now when you have that, a lot of times it's an address of a county or the city, a hall, or you don't get a specific name on there. But for the township, right now they put specific names and a number. And so this would, you could have a P.O. box or something that they still could send a letter to, or they could go through the county, but they just would not have this phone number. And I don't know if anyone from the township. Oh, Mr. Sulem is here. If you wanted to respond to Senator Rest's question. Mr. Sulem?
Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And this was a provision that we did bring forward. And Senator Bach and I did discuss it, and he asked me to work on the House side with the issue because of some timing matters of where the committees were at. So that's how it came from the House instead of on the Senate. But he was fully aware of it, and the timing was coordinated through that process. But because our levies are approved by the voters at the March meeting, we don't hold the hearings, but because it's a general notice of all taxes, we're on the form, and the way the statute reads is that you have to have all the phone number and address on there, and because so many of the townships either don't have a town hall or a town hall that has a phone line, by default they've been listing, the counties have been listing the personal phone number for the town clerks, and that has started to have some problems. And so as Representative Marquardt indicated, they could still send the letters if they had anything to raise, although again it's already been set and voted on. And that can, addresses can be handled in a number of different ways, but the phone numbers, you're stuck with the clerk's phone number or none when they don't have a line at the town hall. So that's why it's structured that way.
Senator Rest?
I'm kind of on the side of a taxpayer here. How do they register a concern? And probably to them, it may not matter that it was something that was adopted months before. They get a statement and they have a question. Who do they talk to?
Senator Rest, one thing about.
Is there a county phone number they can call? I mean,
this
Senator Rest. Language says we don't want you calling anybody. That's what this language says.
Senator Rest, on a township, unlike a city or a county, they set their budget at their annual town meeting, of course, where everyone actually gets there and can voice their opinions, and it's open at that time. So I don't think it's a transparency issue at all. I mean, that was set 8 months. Well, in democracy, if you don't, you know, it's things are decided by those who show up in a direct democracy, of course. But, Mr. Sewell, maybe you
if I may, another option they have is to petition for a special meeting to try to reset the levy. There is a process to call a special town meeting. It only requires a handful of signatures to do that. So there are some other options, but it is because we're not holding these hearings that the notices are the primary intent for. And as been pointed out, they're invited to come to March. They're invited to put their input in. If they can't be there, they can send. They can't vote by proxy, but they can certainly send comments and submit input, which is what the purpose of the notice is anyhow. So we're trying to make an accommodation saying, you know, if this many months after the decision's made, you still want to weigh in, you can send a letter, you can send a postcard, you can come to the next meeting, you can petition for a special meeting. But to help protect the safety of the clerks, we're trying to get the personal phone numbers off the list. And it only applies when they don't have a town hall with a phone line that they could accommodate using the town hall number.
Senator Rest, anything else? Senator Scoy?
Mr. Chair, and maybe to Senator Rest, in the smaller rural townships, I mean, even if they did have a phone number at the town hall, the majority of the time there wouldn't be anybody there, and actually probably a better contact would be to send a letter, because you'd be more certain of reaching someone. Mr. Chair, I'll move House Article 1, Section 18.
Okay. Senator Scoy moves House Article 1, Section 18. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion does not prevail unless, and okay, we see Senator Bach, the motion does prevail. No, it doesn't. No, because he's not a voting member. So it does not prevail. We'll move to. Okay. We can come back to that.
Just saying, you can't contact anybody unless you find out where you can write a letter to the county.
We can, yes. Well, but, Senator Central.
If the provision was to write a letter, obviously there'd be some address, I suppose, but I mean, a township 6 miles by 6 miles square, it's most of my township people would, or a number of them, short of a phone call, would perhaps just drive over and talk to someone, you know, the old-fashioned way. But could there be at least a name on the notice that they could contact? Of course, that's what you don't want, I guess. But
well, I don't, Senator Sanders, I don't think it's the name. It's kind of the number and just direct where they can call them and hassle them and so forth. But we'll come back to that.
Okay.
We'll come back to that.
Senator S. My problem with the language is that it just says the township will tell the county that we don't have a public phone number and the county won't list one, but it doesn't say, it doesn't give an alternative for how the taxpayer can contact if they have a question.
Mr. Sewell, one quick comment.
Mr. Senator Russ, the requirement for the address in the form is actually in existing law, so we're just, that's already there, so it's already on the form. So all we're doing is saying, if you don't have that phone number, the personal number is not listed. So the address would be for the town hall or a P.O. box or whatever the township uses to receive their mail. But that's covered by an existing section of law. That's why it's not in the amendment. We're not changing that provision.
Okay. Senator Rest? I'll move to reconsider. All right, Senator Rest moves to reconsider the last vote. So we'll vote on the motion to reconsider then. Senator Central?
Well, we'll make this motion.
Okay. Motion to reconsider. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion is approved here. So, Senator Central.
Well, why don't you move the motion?
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Article 1, Section 18.
Senator Scoy moves Article 1, Section 18. Senator Senjum.
And then just to clarify, Mr. Chair, that would mean then there would be an address on the form. It would either be a P.O. box or a residential address of sorts.
Mr. Sulem is indicating yes.
Okay.
All right. We're going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carried. And I had started out with the easiest one tonight.
Thank you.
Madam Representative Marquardt, I thought it was pretty interesting as I was in the back of the room observing the very first motion that was made with you and Senator Scoy chairing the committee failed.
We're not doing LLCs.
The very first.
That's why we're only the vice chairs here. All right. I'm going to dig into the box here and pull out another one. We're going to go to page 7, article. How come Senator Bach and Representative Lincheski, when you do go down lists like this, it's so easy? And then.
Was it easy?
Well, sometimes. All right, Article 1, Section 24 on page 7. This one, Article 24. This is the one that reduces from $250 to $100 where you would need to pay one time. Last year we moved it from 50 to 250, and there were some problems with it. So this was Representative Jackson's bill on the House side, and so this moves it to $100. So if it's $100 or less, you'd have to pay in one installment. But over $100 now, you could pay in two installments. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. You know, we had this provision last year at the county's request in order to save money and be more efficient in their operations, and perhaps they should come and tell us what exactly was the outcome of that efficiency effort of theirs and why it didn't work out.
Representative Marquardt, there was a motion in the Senate Tax Committee to lower this $250 number, and it failed. So we did have this discussion. But I'm interested also in hearing what the counties think.
Mr. Matthews, or...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews, Association of Minnesota Counties. Senator Bach is correct. We had hoped to actually alleviate some administrative costs. What we found out was the mechanism and statute that allowed us to aggregate the total value of properties. So if you had, say, five parcels and your total bill exceeded $250 combined, you would be able to make two payments. That programming piece in the software became really difficult. And so our folks felt, after discussions with Ms. Price and our county auditors, that $100 was a value or a level that they would not have to do that aggregation piece, but would also alleviate some of the smaller payments that were coming in two payments instead of one. So that's, I guess, a simple explanation. She's here if you have any follow-up questions.
Any questions? Anything else?
Well, Mr. Matthews, so there was a fair number of people that had a relatively large number of parcels that were under the $250 limit, so they were having to pay a relatively large property tax bill.
Mr. Matthews?
Senator Scoy, our intent last year was that they would actually aggregate that amount, and so they would still make two payments if the aggregate amount of all their parcels was combined. What we found was actually implementing that aggregation process was much more difficult than we anticipated. And so that was where the problem was in the implementation of that piece, not necessarily with the dollar threshold itself. And so the $100 threshold, our folks felt they would not have to go that route, and it was more manageable. And I don't want to speak for the other folks, but there were some farm groups as well that had indicated in the House side that $100 was probably something they could live with. And I don't know if they're here, they can speak for themselves.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Matthews, you're sure the $100 is the right number now?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, comments?
I'll move Article 1, House Article 1, Section 24.
All right. Senator Scoy moves House Article 1, Section 24. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. Next, I'd like to move to Article 1, Sections 35 and 36 on page 9. What this is something that we did last year. This was a tax abatement for 2 years for newly constructed homes in those cities that were in border cities that were also in flood disaster areas. And the reason for this was Senator Langseth's bill on the Senate side and mine on the House side, but we did this for 2 years. And very quickly, back in 1997 when they had the floods, what the border cities saw was a dramatic decrease in their new housing starts. And it was just the flood and the whole works, and also competing with North Dakota. In 2009, in an effort when the area suffered the record flood of 41 feet. It was the same type of fear was going to occur, kind of this market fatigue and concern that you've got the floods and you're competing with North Dakota, and they wanted to make sure this didn't happen again. This year, the seventh highest flood of all time hit the area. And so what they have found is that it has been successful. The first quarter of 2010 has been very successful, and the market has responded, and they would like one more year to make sure that they can kind of stem the bleeding on the housing, but also be able to compete with, you know, the reason the Border City program was set up was because of the competition of the North Dakota cities, Grand Forks, Fargo, Wahpeton, and so forth. So, members, this would extend that from homes that could be constructed up to the end of this year to the end of 2011.
Madam Chair, I don't think there was a bill on this last year, and I think it ended up in the final bill after all.
There was a bill, but it was heard in, I know, Taxes and Ways and Means, I believe, in the House, but I don't know if it was heard, but there was a bill last year that came in late.
So is there a bill this year?
There's no new bill. This is just an extension of that one. Possession
of the end of the year last year.
Yeah, I think the Langseth bill came in after we had moved our bill out, actually.
Yes, it did.
Or it was introduced like the day that we marked up our bill or something, that we put something in by amendment, I remember.
Yes, we did.
Representative Markwart, does Senator Langseth support this provision?
He does. Yes. In fact, you remember last year he upped the ante. We had 150 and he trumped me, came in and did 200.
His idea work out?
It did, and what they're finding is that, especially early on here in 2010, the first quarter has been very successful, and the realtors in the area are crediting that as part of the success.
Nothing else? I'll move Article 1, Section 30, House Article 1, Section 35 and 36.
All right. Senator Scoy moves Article 1, Sections 35 and 36. I think those are the only two we need to do on that. Okay. Any further discussion? If not, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. Thank you very much. House Article 1, Sections 2 and 3, and it's the Senate Article 4, Section 3, page 1. It's that air flight property tax. And maybe we could have staff come up quickly. There's some changes, but I think we may want to accept the House plan because that came out a little bit later where they reach a little more peace in the valley. But at any rate, if staff could come up and...
Oh, after the beard hearing? Was after the beard hearing?
Yes, that was Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, you're right. This is another one of the provisions that we had started to work on, and there was some new language coming in just as our bill was going out, so we didn't pick up the added language or the change language that the House did. But I think it was passed. The committee understood that it needed additional work, so I think the House language is preferable.
Well,
okay, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, and Ms. Soff. One of the questions that we were struggling with, if I remember right, is how the Commissioner of Transportation was going to be sure that he was notifying the Department of Revenue. And has that issue been resolved as to how that transfer of information is going to go between those two departments?
Ms. Baker, is that the new language?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Karen Baker, House Research. I think one of the things that was of concern was, and I think this was, as Ms. Soff said, that it was earlier in your discussion that you got this, but was you struck the language that really said, if in fact they don't certify, then what does the Commissioner of Revenue do? And that was one of the things that got put back in, the House language. I think if you look at the Senate language, you took out the sentence that basically said if a levy amount, you know, hasn't been certified, you know, then the commissioner uses the previous year's number it shall use the last previous certified amount. And you had struck that and hadn't replaced it with anything, so there was a real question about then what do they do? And so the House reinstated that and then also added some language that basically said that if they have any carryover balance in the airport fund, they could also consider that in their estimated revenues. And basically what that would do is it should lower the property tax levy because you're really taking your total minus what you need, and the property tax levy is the rest. And if you have more revenues, then you don't need as much. And if anything, it should reduce property taxes. So it sure doesn't go the direction that you're afraid, and that is that, you know, that it would increase. The one thing, though, that the House did do is it changed the date to December 31st, and then in Section 3 of the bill, it changed when the commissioner would tell the airline companies what the tax is and when that tax would be due by a few months. So those dates were all put kind of in sync with each other. And one of the reasons why the Department of Transportation liked it, and the Department of Revenue because of more time, was it just gave them more time for planning. And having that money come in April was fine with them instead of January. That was not an issue. So it did change the dates, and the Senate doesn't have those date changes that we have in Section 3.
Okay. Senator Skoy, do you have it?
Just so I'm clear, so if there is a question with the Commissioner of Transportation on his certification, they will use the last year's certification?
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
And then according to the Revenue Department, there's no impact on this, no property tax levy increase or decrease.
They look sleepy. They're all nods, but they look sleepy.
Mr. Willett, anything you want to add on this, or Ms. Cadoon? Okay. Ms. Cadoon?
No, Representative. As Karen Baker stated, that's correct, and I think the House language is what we'd be preferring at this point as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator, by.
Mr. Chairman, the reason that this language is here is, I'll just say it on the record, MnDOT wasn't doing their job. I mean, they weren't telling the Department of Revenue how much to levy, so it was automatically defaulting to the previous year's levy. I think that was intentional on their part. And that's why the Senate took that language out, that fallback provision, because that had happened for a number of years.
Yes.
And I think they were giving some very preferential treatment to some very big airlines in this state on their property taxes. And this whole thing wouldn't have come to a head if $15 million hadn't been robbed out of the airport fund. So I was a little frustrated with the way MnDOT's been dealing with this issue, and we were asked to kind of leave the language out of the bill and let them work on it, and I think we made a decision to move ahead, and I do appreciate the fact that everybody then got together and found some resolve here, but I don't think the system was working, and I think moving the dates, we talked about that, is a good idea because it gives them some time to recognize new registrations that they might not have known were coming, new planes that were going to be bought, that a September date, you wouldn't know that money's in the queue, so you might artificially have a property tax levy that's higher than you need.
And Mr. Chair?
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, and the other thing I forgot to say, and you raised it, is that the House also put in language that says that if a levy amount has not been certified, the commissioner shall use the last previous amount to determine the rate of tax and shall notify the chairs and ranking minority members of the committees of the House and Senate having jurisdiction over the Department of Transportation that a certification was not made. And the idea there is that the legislature really knows up front that, hey, you know, you didn't give us a certification. And so that was kind of a red flag that was put in here. That was Representative Beard. He was very concerned about having that known.
Senator Bach, this is your bill.
That's why I know something about it.
And it's a good bill.
Why do you look so surprised?
No comments. Thank you, Ms. Baker.
But, Mr. Chair, what if I move the House language?
Very good. Senator Bach moves the House language. It's Article 1, Sections 2 and 3. Any further discussion on that?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Michelle. Yeah.
Zero.
So zero. That is good. All right. Any further good news? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion carried. Here's another. Let's wait till they leave and we'll get that Clearwater stuff in here.
Where's me tonight?
Trade your Clearwater for sedan.
Can you replace
Senator Moss?
Can he be a voting member? Unless we find Senator
Moss. Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you don't object, we're fine with Senator Olson voting on behalf of Senator Moss.
That's great. It's good.
Well, he's going to call for a quorum.
Yeah, no Green Acres.
Yeah, oh, wait a minute.
As long as there's no roll call votes required.
Yeah.
Very good.
We'll be back.
We will try to hold the fort down.
What's recess?
Be nice if you guys were here when we came back.
Is there any way we could close up a bill before they come back? All right. We're going to move next to House Article 1, Section 21, page 7 on the side-by-side. Members, this...
Which one did you say?
Page 7, Article 21. Article 21. Members, this came in very late. It was not a bill. And it was brought forward. Cities are, of course, allowed to levy back based on their on-allotments and so forth, but there's a couple charter cities that... they could not. And back in 2003, the House and the Senate allowed a two-year for 04 and 05, these two cities to do it. I think it's West St. Paul and Fridley. And so what this does, it would allow it permanently to occur, and we wouldn't have to come back and do this again. So it was late. It was not a bill, and either it was put on by amendment on the House floor for the Tax Committee. So.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like Senator Rest wants to speak to this.
I think it's a good provision to allow them that flexibility in the health economic funds, and they're not going to get any better anytime soon. So I think we need to allow other cities not to be bound by an unrealistic coalition. And they are two metro cities.
Very good.
Is that a motion?
Would you like to make that motion, Senator Rest? All right, thank you. Senator Rest moves House Article 1, Section 21. I will call for the vote. Any further discussion? Call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. We're going to next move to House Article 9, Section 14. It's page 40 of the side-by-side, and it's also Senate Article 4, Section 34, and this is that date change for Class 2B property classes, taxes. And it's
40
for the Senate, it's Article 4, Section 34 on page 40. And this has to do with the 2A and 2B and making sure that folks who have paid a month later in November for ag land won't all of a sudden have to start paying in October. And I think there's a provision also that if they did have to this year pay in October because we haven't adjusted things, that there would be an abatement or some how did that work exactly? Maybe would, is this, who wants to talk to this? Staff or is Mr. Nord from the Department of Revenue, if you would care to speak to this? Just to make sure it's doing what we want it to do, Senator Scoy and members. Thank you, Mr. Nord.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Jason Nord from the Department of Revenue. The problem with, or the question ultimately started with, should the extended due date for of November 15th be limited just to 2A properties or be expanded to 2A and 2B properties? The difficulty is that Class 2B doesn't only include land that was formerly agricultural or formerly had the late due date. It also includes a lot of other types of properties, such as formerly large residential homestead properties that had to be split class into part residential homestead, part 2B, or any other classification of large parcels, parcels that maybe were part resort, that are now part resort and part 2B. And so so there's not a clean match between the old 2B that used to be ag and the new 2B. And so the first part of the House section tries to as closely as possible identify the 2B lands that used to be agricultural and talks about, so it gives it to any 2A lands and any 2B lands that are contiguous to the 2A lands. The second part of the House side deals with Pay 2010. When we talked to the consortiums and asked them how they programmed this, because current law is confusing, we heard from all four computing consortiums that they only granted the later due date to Class 2A properties. They did not grant it to 2B properties. So you may have an issue this year with farmers who have some 2B parcels who may be caught unaware that some of the due date on some of their parcels had changed and is now earlier. So the paragraph B was added in recognition of that and says that the counties should either not impose a penalty or shall abate a penalty if they're essentially caught by that 1 month due date difference. And so paragraph B of the House provision does that for 2 years and sets the permanent change out 3 years. To also give you some time maybe to see if you've got it specified right. But it sets a benchmark out there for the future to shoot for. So those are some of the considerations that went into the difference in the House language.
Senator Rest.
Thank you. Why did we have the provision effective the day following? Was there a particular reason for that?
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Est, I don't know about the effective date, but the issue that is a problem with the Senate language is if we bring all of the 2B property in to this delayed payment time, we're going to bring a bunch of properties in that we don't want to and that weren't previously qualified for that.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Rest, I think the fiscal impact if you're a county with a lot of ag land, that might be a cash flow problem for the county if we delayed payments. But there's another issue that we need to walk through here. And what we're going to end up with is we're going to have landowners that might have a number of parcels, and they're going to have different dates, due dates on their property tax statements. And so that's the reason that the department is proposing this delay in penalty.
And make it all November.
Well, we don't know if we can do that. So one of the things that we have kind of talked and thought about is perhaps we should, make sure that we extend the grace period for not having a penalty for missing their payment. But perhaps the simplest thing to do today is to just extend the time period for not having a penalty and leaving it at 2A and giving the counties and the department some time to analyze which solution is the best, leaving it 2A, doing the language that you currently have here, or, you know, what we're going to end up with. And, you know, as Mr. Nord did mention, we do have a problem with these computer consortiums that none of them currently are able to do both the 2A and the 2B. So we have to work that into this scenario
also.
So
what's the staff recommendation on that sort of treatment that keeps things clear.
Well, let's ask Mr. Nord what his preference is.
Mr. Nord, what would be your preference in all of this?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Just ask
Senator Rest.
What is the staff preference for how the issue is resolved that streamlines it, makes sure that the taxpayer is protected from penalties and that doesn't cause the county's heartburn?
Sure, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I think in our department bill, we originally came forward with only applying the delayed due date to Class 2A property because we believe that the original intent of the delayed due date was the recognition that agricultural income comes in with harvesting late in the year and they need an extra month to make that due date. So we never included any of the 2B. I think the difficulty from an administrative point of view comes in when you start to try to pick some 2B to include in that but leave out other 2B, you then generate programming difficulties which would make it much harder to administer if you try to selectively pick some of the 2B. And if you can pick all of the 2B to include in that, you'd have to just decide whether that meets the original goal of the later due date. I think that so from an administrative point of view, to just waive the penalties so people aren't caught unawares is something that is easy for us to
essentially just leaving the law the way it is, but not penalizing anybody for either misunderstanding or making a payment a month later. Is that the solution that you guys are proposing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what? Senator Scoy, do you have a comment or thought on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, my question was going to be to Mr. Nord is we're one year into it now, and we're doing a two-year delay. Is that enough, or should we contemplate a three-year delay?
Mr. Nord?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I think that's a decision up to you. I think it would be safer to allow more time for the counties to be able to waive that penalty, but I think that's a call you can make. I think either 2 years or 3 years is reasonable, or it's a policy call, I guess.
Well, Representative Marquardt, are you guys okay with leaving it at the 2A category for the delayed payment, but giving us some time for the county and the department to work through this to see what ramifications there are? I think one of the things that's going to happen is if we do allow some 2B to go into this delay payment, we're going to have a lot of confusion about where this line gets drawn. I know it's contiguous, but there are other factors there. And so I don't really have strong feelings one way or the other, but I think at some point it's better if it's just the 2A.
I'm going to ask Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, I was going to maybe ask Mr. Nord a question, which is a little protocol-wise maybe a little odd, but I would point out if we do that, then we still have this language, the 2B3 reference from the old that would still be in current law, and I don't know if you would find that to be a problem to hang on indefinitely if we didn't adopt the change in the basic paragraphs.
Mr. Hines, explain that change that.
Yes, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, the language in law is predates the changes that we made with the agricultural classes. So right now it refers to Class 2A ag homestead property and Class 2B3 ag non-homestead property. That's the current reference. And so if we don't do anything to that paragraph, that reference would still be out there. And of course, that class doesn't really exist anymore. And right. So there might be some ambiguity, but
Mr. Nord, any thoughts on that?
Correct. Mr. Chair, I erred in thinking because we wrote the department bill so long ago, I was already thinking that was current. But yes, current law.
Oh, jeez.
my apology. The current law does need to be clarified. And so the question is, do you clarify it to be only 2A? 2A and 2B, or 2A and some portion of 2B. And I think that last option is the administratively the most difficult. I think our preference and our original proposal was just to change the first to change current law to only refer to Class 2A.
I think, Senator Scoy, the intent here is to have those who were paying on November 15th to continue paying on November 15th with the same parcels of property that were paid on November 15th. Isn't that, and I mean, can that be done? Or is that what we're, I mean, I think that was the intent, Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, that would be accomplished by the second paragraph, which basically says exactly that, that if your due date used to be November 15th, it continues to be. It's a question, but we're looking at that as an interim measure. How long do you want that to go on? But it could go, you know, we have it in for 2 years, and it could certainly be more than that.
Right. Sanders, Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Nord, just wondering about the, what is the penalty if they're late? Is it the same across the state? I mean, every county has the same penalty?
Mr. Nord?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, yes, the penalties are exactly the same. There's a penalty that incurs on the 16th. So if the due date is the 15th, there's a penalty that incurs on the 16th. And then there's a penalty that incurs at the on the first day of every month thereafter. Off the top of my head, I'm not exactly sure what that interest rate of penalty is. 6%? I think it's 6% on the 16th, and then on the first of each month, it becomes 8%. It's on lines... page 148, lines 2 and 6 of the House bill.
Thank you.
Well,
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, and either to Mr. Hines or Mr. Nord, what happens to the parcels that are not contiguous that are 2A? Now, they used to be paid on November 15th, but what is the due date of those parcels going to be going forward?
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, the due date, if a parcel has any Class 2A on it, they would get the later due date. If it's only a 2B parcel, it would not get the later due date. If it's written so that it only applies to Class 2A, if it's written to, if it, as the House language is, where it says 2A and contiguous 2B, then any non-contiguous 2B would not get the later due date, but any contiguous 2B would get the later due date, and that becomes an administrative difficulty for the counties to implement.
Well,
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, I think the safest thing to do is to go with the 2A. I think at the very least we have to extend the time period for there not being a penalty 2 years. If they want to try to put the language in and delay the implementation to see if the counties have a problem implementing it, perhaps we can consider that.
Okay. You want to make a motion of some sort there?
No, I don't exactly know what it should be.
Yeah,
to say to be or not to be.
Thank you. Any, who, how would, I think what we're trying to do here.
He said, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think it's the Senate language for the first paragraph, and it's paragraph B of the House, because paragraph B is the penalty, that penalties imposed or it has to be abated. That's just in the.
Okay.
That puts two.
Yeah, we can't.
That puts the 2B in.
Mr. Hines.
In the late date.
Okay, that puts 2B in as a later date.
It would be the original department proposal for paragraph A would get you only 2A, and then.
Let's strike. Here's what we want to do. Is what we want to do, at least for the next 2 years, I think, while we can iron this out, is to make sure those who were paying on November 15th continue to pay on November 15th. Isn't that? So how do we
That's
get...
paragraph B.
Paragraph B. So that will do that.
Of the House.
Of the House side. Mm-hmm. So those who are currently paying on November 15th will continue to pay on November 15th.
Well, so if you have contiguous parcels that are two different classifications, you want to be able to allow them to also pay on the November 15th.
I think Senator Ressa would only be if they had paid
later.
Yeah, and that's where it gets confusing. Should we come?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think we might need to think about this just a little bit, because just adopting paragraph B just delays the penalty without making any, I mean, it just tells them to do what they currently should do today 2 years from now. It doesn't do anything for us. I think we just need to think about
Let's think about this, and I think the intent still is to try to
We're going to do something here to get some delay in the penalty and perhaps some language that would get the counties to see if they can implement what we used to have in place with this new 2A, 2B.
Let's think about this one rather than try to do this on the fly. So thank you all for your comments, and we'll come back to this one later. Article 1, House Article 1, Section 33, page 9 on the side-by-side. This was something that was in last year's bill. It's a Representative Garofalo provision, and it extends the deadline for application to the Metropolitan Agricultural Preserve Program from March 1st to June 1st for taxable taxes payable. And I remember Representative Garofalo just thought it was maybe kind of a timing thing. I know we didn't do this in the past. Any comments from the department on this one? Okay. Mr. Nord or Mr. Hagen?
Mr. Chair, we don't have any concerns with this provision.
Okay. Senator Skoy.
Why the change?
It was a last year bill, and it had something to do, I think, even with, it might have been payment of taxes were in May, and it'd be after that. But I thought it was some sort of a just giving people a little bit longer time into the year to decide for taxable payable in the following. So, I don't think it's earth-shattering one way or the other. Maybe, yeah. Ms. Baker, do you remember
what
was his rationale?
Mr. Chair, members, the only reason here was because there's really no administrative kind of concern with having to file as early as March 1st. I mean, June 1st just gives more months of time for the person to decide to go into this program, and there really isn't any valuation issue or administrative reason why they have to do it as early as March 1. That date has just been out there for years and years, and I think a constituent called up Representative Garofalo and said, this was like in April, and said, why does it have to be as early as it is? And the county said it really wouldn't have to be, except the law says you have to file by March 1st. So, I mean, I think it was just to extend the date just because of giving people more time during the year to file for this. And it's just the initial application, because once you get into the program, you don't ever file again. So it's just getting in.
Senator Rest?
So what would be the last possible date to be effective? I mean, is June just picked out in half, or is there something that is triggered by June 1st? I mean, why not September 1st?
Ms. Baker.
What's the last possible date?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, you can see that the way the effective date is written, the first year it's extending it to August 1st, and it's much more of an issue of, there aren't that many people going into the Metro Ag Preserve, so it's not like there's a whole flood of people going in. And I think, I think it could be later. I think Representative Garofalo just wanted to move it a few months and thought that was reasonable, but it could be later. Because I think if you ask the department, I think, or the assessors, they'd say that it could be as late as August or September without any problem.
Senator Skoy, or are you?
Well, I think we would, if we're going to move it at all, let's move it to a date where people have as much opportunity to make that choice without having any effect. So why not make it August 1st period?
Now we have Mr. Hagen moving.
Whoa, Mr. Chair, before
Senator Skoy.
To Senator Rest's point, I mean, you can sign up for this any day of the year. The question is, when does it affect this year's tax?
Right, right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, what is the date that...
What's the cutoff date?
Okay.
What's the cutoff
date? Mr. Hagan, what would be kind of the latest date that things could still work?
Mr. Chair, members, you're going to be disappointed in my answer, but the department really deals so little with ag preserve. It's primarily a zoning classification that's based on individual county zoning. We checked with several counties, and they were comfortable with the June 1st class, the date. I think it's more of a county issue if they're comfortable moving it back further or not. Nobody expressed any concerns at all for moving from March to June, so perhaps even going later wouldn't be a problem.
Representative Loeffler.
Representative Loeffler. Mr. Chair, members, it's another area I know a lot about, but I was thinking, isn't there like a June 1st deadline to establish a homestead to be recognized? And, you know, when we talk about having consistency and simplicity, I mean, it might be useful to just have one date for...
That's December.
Is that
December?
I thought there's two dates.
December 15th.
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Loeffler, December 15th is when you have to have filed for the homestead for that whole year for taxes paid.
Representative
Loeffler.
There isn't
such a thing as half anymore. Yeah.
I'm always learning.
All right. Any motions?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Article 1, House Article 1, Section 33. This is what the author wanted. It doesn't appear to be an issue. Let's just go with June. If somebody wants to move it again, they can move it.
We have a motion for House Article 1, Section 33. Any further discussion on that? If not, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. Next one. Close by there. Article 1. House Article 1, Sections 31 and 32, which is page 8. This was a Representative Scalzi bill. And this, I can find my right page here. This deals with housing improvement areas. And it would... increase the percentage. Let me get this right, because there's two percentages on here. It increases the percentage from 35% to 45%, and they're required to veto a fee increase. It seems like, let's see here, there's two different ones. Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, I think when I talked to the department about this, they explained this. There's two percentages in here. First of all, there's an increase in the number of petitioners required for a project to be approved from 25 to 50.
That's it.
And a percentage increase to veto a current project from 35 to 40.
Yes. And Ms. Baker, anything to add on that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think... there are the two percentages. The first one that was increased is to actually petition for the district, and the second one is the requirements for the veto. The reason why they wanted to raise the petition in percentage is because they spend a lot of time and a lot of money to kind of figure out whether or not they should do this project. And if they only have 25% of the people that really want it, because that's what the petition, these are by petition, so it's the people that own these units that really want this thing done. And if they only have that many, then they run into resistance later when they have all their later meetings and hearings with the city. And so they said, let's make sure that we have at least 50% of the people that petition that really want it to start with, so that we know it's kind of a good deal for the whole building, because these are townhouse structures and they're large, you know, units that have, you know, maybe 30, 40, 50 units, and they want to make sure there's enough people in there that really want this work done. On the veto power, or the veto, they want more people They want to raise that petition from 30, or that percentage from 35 to 45, so that it takes more to veto the project. So they want more going in, but they also want the percentage to be higher to end the project. So it kind of works on both sides. And this was Representative Scalzi's.
Thank you. Senator Scoy?
Yeah, Ms. Baker, I'm not familiar with this type of structure. So these are all individually owned units in a multiple housing facility. Yeah. And so they're going to require 50% of the owners of these units to sign a petition before they can start the planning for a project? Is that a little bit of a high bar?
Housing improvement, Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, a housing improvement area is really a defined area in a city where you've got housing improvements in like a condo or a town home complex. And what you're doing is you're financing with the assistance of the city or the city's EDA or the city's HRA, because the people that are there can't afford to do the work. And so, you know, let's say you've got some kind of rundown condos that those people really want to do something to that condominium complex, but they just can't get the financing. This is one way for them to improve the housing, and the city comes in and works with them and the bonding is done by the city, but they want to make sure that there's enough people in that condominium complex that really want the work done. And so that's why that percentage is raised, to make sure that they don't go through a lot of work and then find out that there aren't, in fact, that many people that want to pay for it, because these are all privately. It's like a special assessment, but they can be fairly high because they're pretty major improvements. I mean, it's things like roofing and siding and landscaping and roadways and walkways, and, you know, it's some pretty major things.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Baker. So it's like an association
fee.
Yeah, feedback.
It is. Yeah.
Okay.
Any comments? Senator Scoy? Thank you.
Seems reasonable. I'll move House Article 1, Section 31. Well, you guys are doing pretty well today.
And 32.
And 32.
You've been, yeah. So, Senator Scoy
first little
moves Article 1, Section 31 and 32. I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carry. Thank you. Boy, I'm just moving right along here. After that early one, that's... Well...
I wonder.
Oh.
Senator Olsen, is there a Senate section in there that we're
there are
working
a couple
on?
Senate provisions.
All right.
We're making progress toward
We'd you. Like to move to Article 1, Section 34, page 9 of the side-by-side. This is a St. Charles provision. Let me just give you a little history of this. This is a Representative Gruskowski bill. Couple years ago, last year there was a fire at St. Charles. A major business was destroyed. There was funding in actually two separate bills last year. In the bonding bill, there was authority for funding up to $242,000 for potential loss of declining pupil enrollment. And then in the tax bill, there was a sales tax exemption for if the company built anew. What happened is there were really hardly any pupil decline, so those dollars did not come to fruition, and the company did not rebuild, so the sales tax also didn't take effect. And so what they're looking at is now an economic development site, and they came in and looking for money. So this bill puts it in the LGA, one-time funding for $50,000 for each of the next 2 years. Senator,
what does it mean when the payment is made within the current LGA appropriations? That mean they get $50,000 off the top and the rest is distributed to the criminal?
Senator Rest, that's correct.
So the people are durable by helping the people obtain jobs.
The fine state, isn't it?
correct. Senator Scott. Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, and you know, we did. Well, we did hear have a bill relating to St. Charles, and it was something to do with a transfer of an education payment that they hadn't utilized because their enrollment didn't decline. And I don't know. I'd like to know a little more about what exactly their needs are here. I was talked to by Senator Murphy today about this provision. And so I kind of think maybe we just need to hold a little while on this and see if I can and work with Senator Bach and Senator Murphy and see exactly what's going on with St. Charles.
Okay, that Senator S.
What was magical about
50,000? Senator Rest, there wasn't anything magical about that.
Was it just on average?
Yeah. You know, we it's the state's done this before, these kind of one-time payments, of course. And so there was.
It's going to be transferred out of education to the city.
Happened to that.
But initially it was 242 out of the bonding bill. So. Okay. Okay. Very good.
That's the bill I talked
okay,
about.
So roughly it was the dollars referring to the declining the out of that 242 was kind of
relative to
it?
That.
Yeah.
So is that that butter factory?
Yeah. Yes.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, that was the butter factory that burned, and
It doesn't matter. It was poultry, chickens.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, tons of chickens.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a disaster that befell the town, and I would hope that you may delay it or whatever and get what information you need. But I think that it's one of the things that we should do as a state when one of our communities suffers a serious disaster and is having some continual problems, that if we can do something that's helpful, that we should.
Okay, Senator Scoy.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that's right. And I wonder, maybe Senator Senjum, you can help me from down that way. Didn't they have a flood? I mean, there was a series of events that fell this community.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, yes, St. Charles was devastated. And I'm trying to remember when we almost classically call it the Rushford flood, but that whole southeastern Minnesota, St. Charles was also hit in a devastating sort of way. I remember well driving through it. It was, especially the north side, it was just, well flooded and a lot of personal disaster there for people. I mean, lives weren't lost, but a lot of property was lost. And then to become pounded with the fire, and I want to say it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 250 employees were working at that poultry processing plant, and that had a big effect on that community. So they suffered a double hit within a short period of time. I'm not sure if it was a year or so, but they're a fine community. They're a progressive community. I would just say to the extent we can help them out, I hope we can look at it. I would be willing to if we were defer this till another day, call their mayor, city council person, administrator, and have them come up here and give us a good story if you want it.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, Minnesota, we have a history of helping communities when they struggle with disasters. But, I'd also like to think that we wouldn't be taking this out of the current LGA payment. There's a relatively small dollar amount, and, we're going to try to raise some revenue in this bill. And, if we raise some revenue, perhaps there will be, the money to make that support for St. Charles. But let me talk to Senator Murphy.
Very good. Well, we're going to hold off on this for now. Very good. All right.
I had my New Holland butter and my St. Charles
chickens
mixed in.
Senator Scoy, did you have a question?
Well, I'll talk to you in a little bit.
We can move to Article 1, Section 38. Article 1, Section 38, which is number 10 on the side-by-side. This is the Thief River Falls Airport Authority special levy, and just a little history. This is Representative Olin's bill, and what he's looking to do and request by the folks there in Thief River Falls is when they do the levy, it would be applied to the school operating levy, that same levy where the agricultural land and the seasonal rec is exempt. And the reason for that is that in an area like this, a lot of times when you expand government spending, it tends to fall disproportionately on certain types of land. In this case, in this area, it's ag land. So the benefit of those who benefit from this, it doesn't match who's paying for it. And so when you get situations like this, like in Thief River Falls, what can happen is you have this mismatch of costs versus those who benefit, and therefore you might not get a project that people might otherwise be willing to pay for if the benefit and the cost were more evenly matched. But in this case, with a larger percent of ag, they put this out, the levy, it's going to really hit that. So that's, I guess, the rationale behind this. And
how much CI property do they have?
Turn around now. Polaris?
Thief River Falls. Well, Thief River Falls has DigiKey for one place. This year, you remember in the bonding bill, I believe there's some dollars for the airport there, potentially.
Yes, there was.
For DigiKey. And this, they have a levy for things, and they just feel it would be a more fair situation if they could apply this same type of school levy type of thing on the ag lands. But I don't know the exact answer.
Yeah.
Senator Scoia.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Senator Rest, this is my neck of the woods. And they do have a couple of fairly large CI, ArtiCat, and DigiKey is there. This is more complicated than just giving an exemption for a shift. And I'm not sure that we want to do the shift, and I'm going to get to that point. What's going on, it was a city airport, and now they're becoming a regional airport. So it's moving away from city-managed, city-owned to county-run and county in cooperation with the city. They are adding a relatively small county-wide levy on to help with the operation of the airport as they regionalize it. The farmers are objecting to the relatively small bond levy. My point to them is do they not use the airport? Don't they get parts air freighted in? Don't they travel to the cities ever? And the other issue that I really have with this is that if we exempt this class of property for this certain situation, what other class is going to come in and want to get exempt for theirs? I mean, maybe the CI in Hoboken doesn't want to pay for something that would primarily be a benefit to some egg processing plant or something. So I'm really nervous about going down this road. I certainly am going to want to have some discussions with Chair Bach on this before we would adopt this.
Senator Rest?
Our property tax policy is very complicated. We try and make it fair based on even ability to pay, quite frankly, in the classification system. And then to come around and say, well, we're going to game the classification system as well. I have problems with that.
Members will consider
really
this another day.
We need to hold on this. And I'll talk to Senator Stump. Again, this is his provision, and I've had discussions with him previously about this and expressed my concerns about exempting this class of property. I don't know if the department has any opinion on this, but maybe they'd want to kind of weigh in and what they think of the precedent that we would be setting here.
Anyone want to?
Mr. Chair, Beth Cadoon with the Department of Revenue. Senator Skoy, yeah, we have the same thoughts that Senator Skoy just expressed, which is just the precedent of doing this provision, kind of allowing one individual taxing authority to use a separate tax base that would be used from other authorities, and so you'd be kind of setting a new precedent by doing this, as well as, you know, the usual that obviously this does then add to the complexity of the system as well.
Well, we'll come back to this another day. So.
Yeah, I think you'd come back to it when the full committee's here.
Sounds good. Thank you. Let's move to
Green Acres.
Article 1.
We've got Rick here. He's here all night. We got at least
Section
talk about
13 of the House bill, page number 4. Getting closer.
LLCs. You know, you had a pretty good run there, Representative Marquardt, but I think you might be running
out. I understand. I understand here. Hang on. Let's see. This is Section 13. Oh, okay. This one here. What this is that right now, if... you must have just one ownership, of course, for a homestead. Must have exactly the same ownership. And yet, if you are a shareholder or a member or a partner of a family farm corporation or LLC, the law treats that just like you have like you're a separate entity. And so then you lose this homestead. And yet... if you have a partner or a family member or an LLC, in all kind of effect, you are still, the use of the land is the same and everything else remains the same. So what I'm saying is that our state law and our homestead law in this case isn't keeping up with some of the things people want to do as far as estate planning or other types of things. And so what this would say that if you have a homestead and there's also another family member or LLC, that even though they may be two entities, you would be able to qualify for the Tier 1 homestead, you know, 0.5 up to the first tier, which is a little over $1 million. So let's say one was $700,000 and the other one was $600,000. $300,000 of that second one would still apply. So in effect, what it's trying to say is, you know, current law, in my view, is too tight. And this would allow you to still use the property exactly as it's being used. It really isn't a change. You're just changing kind of how the ownership is working in some respects. So I know, Senator Skoy, you've got more experience in this area than I certainly do, but that's kind of the context for the bill. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ress probably has more experience than either one of us. But, you know, when you're organizing your business or your farm, you organize as an individual or a family partnership or an S-stock corporation or an LLC, and they all have pluses and minuses. And one of the pluses to being an LLC is that there's some limited liability within the ownership structure of that. And part of the trade-off for getting that currently is that they don't qualify for some of the homestead classifications. You know, I think it's a trade-off. If they want to qualify for the homestead, they can organize differently. I personally, we do have that state tax provision in here dealing with non-residents that we're going to want to get some traction on too. Have a concern with this direction of organizing toward LLCs. Because of the liability provisions in there. And I am uncomfortable with, you know, without really understanding the rationale why they should qualify for homestead under that business organization.
Senator Rest.
I agree with you. I think we assume that when someone chooses a business organizational structure, that the primary reason for it is not the tax treatment, and it is for other business purposes. And then to turn the thing on its head and say, okay, well, you chose that, and now we're going to give you a tax preference that that should not have been part of the decision for how the ordinance would start with, that seems to me to be contrary to the public policy itself, unless there's some extraordinary reason for turning it over.
Senator Scully.
Representative Marker, you know, we do have a little LLC provision in here for dealing with some Green Acre stuff. Well, it was kind of an extraordinary circumstance, and we'd give it to them for just a couple of years so that a few of these people who got hooked up into this Green Acres transfer could get through. But we certainly didn't have any intention of making that an ongoing policy that would, you know, move forward. So I would have to have a little more convincing as to why they should get this preferential tax treatment.
And this was a Representative Westrom provision, and I think his point is, and my point is, that, you know, when you're looking at legal and estate planning, you know, are we going to give a little leeway here? Now, there might be a trade-off, but in effect, the use of the homestead, you know, nothing has really changed. And so I guess the policy point is, you know, do we want to allow a little more flexibility in, you know, legal and estate planning in these situations? Or not. I mean, that's. I understand it's a change in that respect. Any other comments on this? Well, it doesn't sound like we have a unanimous decision here, so we will hold off on this.
You know, Representative, I think when Senator Bach gets here, he might be your third vote.
Very good.
Tom might be the third vote. I'm pretty sure you and I went.
Yeah, and there may be. All right, I can sense that, so I will not call for a vote here or push one. All right. Well, I feel a little bit like the Minnesota Vikings. I started out very, very good and then headed towards, you know, some of the late season games against the Bears and the Panthers, and I'm hoping I'm gearing up towards the Cowboys in the playoffs that first game. So we'll move to... Yes, Senator Rest.
Did you read that Tom today in a story about Ruben, who was out there and flies to Florida to play for twice a week? Somebody answered him on how far they had gone. And he said, well, to the playoffs. And then the person in the past said, so where'd you play?
Well, we're going to talk food here for a second. We're going to move to Article 1 and the first part of Section 15. Page 5 on the side-by-side. This is a Representative Hosh. We're going to try a little processing here. See if this works. This is looking at cheese and milk. This would be a homestead. Everything would be produced on site. And what he's looking at is for that to classify as 2A agricultural product. Class 2 agricultural products. Senator Scoy.
Representative, has this provision been in the House bill in previous years? It seems familiar to me, but I don't remember it being heard in the committee.
Senator Scoy, this one was not. So this was Representative Hosh's. I mean, we put limitations in here. It had to be less than 10 acres, include a residential structure. Milk is produced on the property.
Well,
so we put a lot of restrictions on
three
this.
Of those.
Well, Representative Marco.
Senator Skoy.
This would be a CI business, then, that would be getting the agriculture classification. That's kind of what's going on. And will we not be opening ourselves up for the honey processors and the wool knitters and the
maple syrup.
Maple syrupers and who knows what to come along and ask for the same treatment on their horse people? I think there's been some discussion with tack shops, maybe.
It could certainly be seen that way. That's why we tried to really limit it down quite a bit. You know, it's small, the residents on there, it's produced on site. Any other comments from anyone?
Senator Rest, what do you think of this one?
Senator Rest? Senator, Representative Erdahl.
I could say something. Of course, agriculture is a business. It's classified differently, but I would speak in favor of this if it's helping a small dairy operator trying to do some more with his business. I don't think it's a bad thing to do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Steen.
If this was a dairy farmer that was processing milk at his own milk, wouldn't be an issue. Is that correct?
It's his own milk.
Oh, yeah, no, this is produced on site.
So it's their...
Yes, it is produced, but they're processing it in the cheese.
I think...
Representative Erdahl.
Mr. Chairman, and just continuing a little bit, we have a growing organic industry in the state, and I think this would help them out too. I think there would be more of them than just this person that would fit into that category.
Senator Skoy.
In their house?
Well,
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, I'm reading the bill here, and we're now going to be giving the commercial processing of milk into cheese products from milk produced on the property. And it's going to have the same treatment as insects, primarily bred to be used as food for animals, game birds, waterfowl breeding on a shooting preserve, maple syrup taken from trees grown by a person licensed. So there are some. They're not as commercial as the production of milk and cheese, probably. We have livestock, dairy animal, dairy products, poultry products. Why don't they fall into that one? Reading in the wrong place here. Hi.
Mr. Hagan is up to the table. Would you want to hear from him, Senator Skoy?
Sure.
Mr. Hagan, your thoughts on this?
Mr. Chair, we were at the House when this bill was heard, and Representative Hosh added the provision in response to Representative Mulry's concern in our response that anybody's milk could be produced into cheese. They added the requirement that it had to be milk produced in the property. We're still a little nervous with the possible expansion. This is in acreages of less than 10 acres is where it would deviate from some of the other milk production instances. It would be nice if we could find a way, if you could find a way to quantify the amount of production. Right now it's just a production of cheese, so it could be one brick of cheese that would qualify for the ag classification. If there was, as you mentioned, Senator Skoy, with the maple syrup, there's a requirement to have to be licensed. If there was a licensure requirement or something like that that would quantify it or link it to some amount of actual agricultural production, we'd be happier with it.
So it sounds like Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hagan, in other words, to quantify a poundage.
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, if there was some sort of licensing procedure, such as there is with maple syrup, that would certainly satisfy our concerns. And I would think if they're producing a product for human consumption, there must be some sort of state health inspection or some sort of licensing requirement. If there was that, they would have enough commitment to be involved to be actually producing a product, which would be a reasonable reflection to have it classed as agricultural, instead of just as producing a brick of cheese to try to get the A classification.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hagan, should we not possibly think about an upper limit? I mean, it's conceivable. You know, I toured a dairy farm in Idaho a number of years ago that was milking 12,000 cows three times a day. And they had a facility on site for processing that milk. Would that processing facility qualify for the ag classification under that scenario?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, in my estimation, in that instance, if they're actually producing cheese on site, the cows obviously would be an agricultural pursuit. I think the production of food for sale as cheese would likely be a commercial product or an industrial classification.
Chair,
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, that's actually what they were doing. They were making mozzarella cheese, and they were making cheese that was put on pizzas all over the country at that farm. It was quite an operation. Never seen anything like it. It was unbelievable.
Mr. Chair?
Senator?
It was larger than 10 acres.
Senator Scoy is right. I mean, why do we need this language? Because it says at 21.8, livestock, dairy animals, dairy products. Wouldn't that already fall under that classification?
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I believe in this instance it's less than 10 acres, and there's the four criteria for less than 10 acres. Nice. We would not fall into that.
Well, Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, how many gallons of milk can they be producing off of cows if they only have 9 acres? It takes about 5 acres to produce the feed for one cow. I mean, it's not a very significant.
A lot of bales.
Well, I think what I'm hearing is some questions and some concerns. So I do know if just it would be just a few agricultural homesteads would be impacted. But I'm hearing concerns, so we will put this off to the side for the time being. We are going to move to Article 1, Section 11, which is page 3. Side by side, dealing with new relative homesteads.
You know, Mr. Chair, you might have better luck if you do a Senate provision.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, you might recall this was here last year as well. It was brought to me by neighborhoods in Minneapolis that are concerned about how many single family homes are being turned into dormitories by their parents as their children go to school, or others who are investors, and that doesn't really stabilize the housing in the area. And I started talking to people who in greater Minnesota have campuses in their district, and they're finding a challenge with that as well. And so that was the original impetus, but now that and then there's been the discussion about family members helping other family members get into housing, and it's actually kind of evolved now that the maximum value of a homestead is about $304 a year. I mean, that's not a whole lot of help compared to if, say, the parents wanted to help their children acquire a homestead, a place to live. It actually works financially better for both parties. In a relative homestead, you're not allowed to get renter's credit. For the children, the adult children they're trying to help to get into housing, they probably actually get more benefit if they're paying some kind of a rent to help cover it. That's often the case. If they could get the renter's credit refund, then this 304 would actually take away some of the administrative responsibilities related to the assessors and just keeping track of these things as they go back and forth between different property statuses and near campus areas. And So it seems to me like it's a classification that was really put in back when homestead credit was really a much more substantial financial benefit, and that there may be better ways now for families to be able to help each other without kind of making this kind of a complicated classification structure. And it does have some social costs as well when you have what is really designed to be stable owner-occupied housing flipping into rental and back and forth. And so that's why I've continued to bring this forward, because it's really kind of a loose of its value in terms of actually a means to help someone. This would not affect ag homesteads. Those have a whole different set of issues and challenges related to inherited property and family operations working together.
Senator Rust.
How big a problem is it? I mean, over the last 5 years, how many relative homesteads have been created? I'm assuming Minneapolis and Paul, what we've been looking at. Do you have statistics on this?
Senator Representative Wofflin.
Rust, I could actually bring, I think I still have in my office, I'm not sure, a map that the city of Minneapolis did that showed the increasing, it was pretty dramatic. And then it was interesting talking to people who have who represent districts with Minscu campuses that are seeing that same sort of phenomenon happening. And what's interesting is that it really isn't necessarily financially the best route to go, but somehow this has kind of gotten out there. And it's being used, I think, by some to market that kind of conversion and selling properties that might not be quite as desirable, and quite honestly, we'd like to see an owner occupant go in and start doing some fix up rather than having it kind of going into properties with lots of students. It's been destabilizing to particular neighborhoods. I know the Marcy Holmes neighborhood near the University of Minnesota, they've had a hard time. They have had a really dramatic difference in terms of the nature of that neighborhood. There's almost no permanent homeowners in big sections of that community as a result. But like I say, its original intent, as I understand it, was to help people, help someone else in their family. And if you think about it, if they were to buy a single family home, say a parent helping an adult child get established, if they were to, they rented, they could actually get the depreciation, the parents would get the depreciation, their children would get the renter's credit. I mean, there's actually some better tools if that was the policy goal. But right now it's being used as a way to market conversions to people who don't really understand our tax structure.
Senator Rust. Representative Wofflin.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rust, I haven't talked to him about this recently. I know that he has been hearing. He actually represents more of that type of housing than I do. I mean, this is Representative Kahn represents the area with the highest concentration. I have 5,000 rental properties in my district that are over two to four units or beyond. This is talking just with the conversion of single family. I suspect in the other side of that Senate district, it's even higher numbers. So I know that the Minneapolis University, U of M's University Minneapolis partnership has been trying to address this in a whole bunch of different ways, and this is one of their recommendations. We had last year, not this year, taken testimony on it.
Senator Rust. Representative Wofflin.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rust, we had presented this to the conference committee last year, and it was a new concept to the Senate, and you really wanted some time to think about it. We did not have any short
answers. Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wofflin, didn't we do something with an affidavit or something so that we could keep track? Or yes. What was the outcome of all of that?
Representative Wofflin, good question.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scoy, we did pass a provision that when properties in a city of a certain size, and staff could help me with what that was, when they changed status, that there had to be some notification or registration with the city. But not sure that I'm up to date on what that those splits were.
Sandra Skoy.
Maybe staff or the department would want to tell us what we did with that affidavit, and has there been any outcome of that? I don't recall.
Yeah, we did. But can anyone answer that question? Ms. Off?
I think a few years back we had a requirement that or an authority for cities above a certain size to require registration of these properties.
Brooklyn Park.
And I don't know if any of the cities have done that, but that was enacted a few years back.
So.
It's Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center. Look at the test or something.
Okay. Well, we don't know for sure if anyone's done that
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe we ought to do a little research and see if we can figure out exactly what's going on, because, you know, we're sympathetic to the issue, and I think we did something that was, I thought we'd done something that was going to bring us some information, but maybe we don't have it.
All right. Well, sounds like we don't have a motion for that, so we'll hold off on that one. So
yeah, we got a date. We can do stuff tomorrow. So let's
very
look
good.
At it. Tomorrow.
Let's okay. Let's look at.
We're right there on that section, Article 4.
Article 4, Section 15.
Oh, so
page
close.
2 on the side by side, Green Acre property transfers. Anyone care to speak to Senator Skoy? This is Green Acres property transfers.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this was a Senator Erickson Ropes provision, and there were a couple of one family, I guess, down in Winona County, and the parents had put the land in an LLC, and then we went through all this Green Acres Rural Preserve stuff. And we didn't allow the land to automatically qualify for Green Acres if it was an LLC. And so this is an effort to fix that for this one, really just one family that we know of. There might be other ones. But, it obviously would expire in 2013 when that Green Acres special treatment goes away. So it's only for a couple of years. And we thought it was a pretty modest effort. I do want to make sure from Senate Council that the language that we have actually does what I think it does. So I want to, Ms. Soff, if you could, does the language do what we want it to do?
Ms. Soff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I did discuss the language some more with the department yesterday, and I think we're okay with this. There was a misunderstanding of some of the testimony when this bill was presented to the committee.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Anyone have any comments? Department, any comments on this? Ms. Cadoon?
Mr. Chair, members, no, we're fine with this provision.
Well, I would move go ahead.
Sandra, you've been moving several of ours.
Yeah.
Would anyone care to move a Senate provision here tonight?
I'll move it.
Representative Erdahl moves Article 4, Section 15. Any further comment? Now I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know where you were thinking of going, but being that Senator Olsen is here, and, you know, we do have that Green Acres property valuation, and he's worked really hard with the department on this issue, you know, it might be timely if we would have some discussion about Section 16.
That sounds good. Where are we? Okay, so we're at, let's look at Article 4, Section 16, Green Acres Property Valuation.
Well, Mr. Chair and members,
I
appreciate the opportunity to sit at the table tonight, and there's two bills in this that I'm very passionate about, and this is one of them. And I've worked with the department and Senator Skoy, and briefly what we've done here is that
The Green Acres formula calculation is based on five counties in southwestern Minnesota down by Worthington. And the problem with that is that it turns out to be an apples-to-orange comparison with a lot of the other agricultural lands throughout the state that qualify for Green Acres, and it's because it's such fine agricultural land. It produces 250 bushels of acre of corn, and, you know, there's cash rents we hear of $300 an acre, and we have verifiable sales from the department of $5,300 an acre in Rock County for land that is just for farmland. There's no pressure for housing. So what this bill basically does is that the University of Minnesota, the Department of Applied Economics, will work with counties in the department so that they'll figure a calculating number for each county, and it'll be based on land sales, on production levels, on rents, and soil conditions in each county. So then that formula will be multiplied over the base, and then that will be the number that counties will use for calculating their Green Acres values. So I think this will go a long way to kind of individualize each county over a base that may not be a very good comparison. I think this is a leveling factor, and it will make the Green Acres formula much more fair and effective, I believe.
Senator Osteen, when you look at like production levels and soil conditions and looking at some sort of a formula, I mean, is this something the Department of Revenue would need to work out, or is this something that the University of Minnesota has already worked on? I mean, is there something out there that currently exists? Because, you know, last year, you know, market values went up 30% based on those five counties. Now, it sounds like for next year there may not be any change in those. And so, you know, next year folks will not be coming in talking about this. But now you get a different system that may or may not be different than what you're getting here, you know, where of the five counties, it may go up, or, you know, it may go different than what that would be. Are we really, I mean, are we solving a problem here in trying to get what seems to be kind of maybe a simple system, making it a lot more complex for each county now has to do a formula? I mean, I don't know, and I guess I'd be willing to watch. I'd like to ask the department that. I'm just a little worried about the complexity of it potentially.
Mr. Chair, I would like Mr. Hagen to address that, but I will mention that we have a very diverse state. And the soil conditions, as I mentioned, in the southwestern part of the state versus in my part of the state are, I mean, there's no comparison. We're lucky to grow 100 bushels of corn an acre and get $40 or $50 cash rent. So there's really not a good, if you multiply that over the base, your Green Acres valuation doesn't really mean anything. So this formula, I believe, will give you a number for your Green Acres value that will really help the farmers.
Senator Skoy, and then we'll go to Mr. Hagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I want to say how hard Senator Olsen has worked on this. He has put a lot of time into this. We've had a lot of meetings with the department, worked through a lot of the issues that I think you're addressing. But what I want to say is this portion of the Green Acres was an issue prior to any of the changes that we made over the last few years, because the department was already implementing this formula mechanism in order to try to come up with a uniform valuation that would go across the entire state. And the department was looking for true ag sales, and the only place that they really could find them was down in the southwest corner of the state. Now, when they were looking at this, we were having some discussions, and, you know, one of the issues that, you know, comes to mind is that even though you've got this historic ratio of values that go on, and they go back a number of years, that you're analyzing, just the nature of agriculture is that those counties down in the southwest that are primarily corn and bean country, when the price of corn and beans goes up, you know, their land values will tend to track along a little bit with that. Now, if you're up in the middle part of the state where it's more dairy and animal agriculture, their commodity prices are going south because the cost of food is going up. So there's a kind of an inverse relationship going on. And this is an effort to try to get at some of that. We're not trying to, you know, be real prescriptive to the department, but we also want them to have flexibility and a little direction so that this formula mechanism is not just a static formula that just is locked in time, but they can continue to work on and adjust and make better. And I think for people who've kind of been tracking along with this Green Acres discussion, I think we do find examples where a little flexibility is needed. And Senator Olsen has, you know, put a lot of effort into this, and I think you know, you've been working with the department, and you know, I think we've got some language here that really is helpful. And so that's my perspective, and we'll let the department.
And I must say, I do know Senator Olsen has been working very hard.
Well, Representative Market, is he?
I know, I appreciate it. He has.
Has he talked to you in the last day or so?
See, I've seen him at least 6 or 7 times in the last 4 days, and I've seen my wife zero. So there you go.
Mr. Chair, I thought I was a House member for a while there.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know who can answer this, maybe Senator Olsen, but it's my impression the southwestern part of the state doesn't have very much green acreage. Is that true? How much green acres is there in the southwest?
Senator Olsen?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, I believe that there's very little, but I'll defer that to Mr.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Representative Erdahl, what drives the determination as to whether there would be a significant amount of green acres would be whether there are outside pressures on the land valuation. And they could be from recreation to housing to whatever. Now, when you get into these counties where 90 you know, plus percent of the usage of the land is agriculture, there would be not a lot of opportunity for outside pressures.
Representative Erdahl, here's a map. And the darker the green, the more green acres land. So you can see down here in the southwest, there is not much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator
Skoy. I would caution you, that is a pre-law change map, and there were 37 counties that didn't implement green acres at that time. That was one of the rationales for the changes that we were making in law, is so that all counties would be implementing this uniformly, and it would truly be a state program.
Excellent point, Senator Skoy. Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, members, this is tough stuff. This ag valuation is very, very difficult, and it's very controversial. We are always looking for ways to improve our work, and we thought and we worked real closely with Senator Olsen, and we appreciate his input. We're always trying to find the way to come up with the perfect value for farmland, which is extremely difficult when you look at all the different economic considerations that affect farmland. We, at no level, want to depart from the sales basis, the ad valorem basis for taxation. We want to make certain that sales comparison approach is the basis for all real estate valuations. We're willing to talk to the University of Minnesota. We're willing to talk to anybody that has some knowledge of farmland values. And as I said, we're always trying to make a better product for the counties and for all the farmers in the state. Having said that, and we worked really closely with Senator Olsen, and I think I have a good sense what this language says. However, I've been approached a number of times in the last few days by the MAO and by some staff questioning what we are doing here and exactly what we're doing. So with that in mind, we would like to maybe work with staff and try to make a few minor changes that makes it a little more apparent what we're trying to do. There's some concern that we're moving away from the sales comparison approach and the valuation to production. That's certainly not our intent. And if it's confusing now, it'll likely be a lot more confusing in 5 or 10 years. We do want to embrace different perspectives. We want to look at different technologies and work with the University of Minnesota to make certain where there's issues, we do our very, very best to come up with the appropriate valuation of property and to work with the counties to do that. We want to make sure also that we don't create a lot of confusion for future generations to try to have to deal with. And we do not want to depart from the sales comparison approach and the sales basis for taxation. So what we'd like is maybe an opportunity tomorrow to work with staff and try to – we've got a few suggestions now that I think makes it a little bit clearer that it's recommended to work with the university and consider other things, but not that it's mandated to go to production value or crop values. So,
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was kind of addresses the question that I had, that it was effective for assessment year 2011. And I'll be the first to admit I'm struggling to learn all the ins and outs of ag property. But one of the lessons I took away from the controversy about Green Acres was that, in part, there was a big, strong reaction to just unexpected change. And some of it was caused by the market more than it was by policy. But it seems to me that having developed the model and modeling it before we make it a policy so quickly seems to me something that would provide an opportunity for people to actually anticipate the impacts. And also the concept that we have to contract with, you know, the U, I assume that to have the model be dynamic, that would have to be an ongoing relationship, which I don't know how it fits within that college of the U, or whether it's something they would develop and then hand off to the Department of Revenue. But, you know, I just feel like the message I got from so many of the people who came and who had really serious concerns, and I know you've heard from them and they continue to look to you as a leader, Senator Olsen, is just that element of surprise and so on. In particular about making it effective so quickly, to me, it makes me a little uncomfortable when it sounds like the model hasn't yet been developed or won. But correct me if I'm wrong, and if you've been working with the U and they actually have some things that people have seen.
Well,
Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to say that, you know, we've worked with the department closely, and, you know, implementing this, I'd rather go on the side of caution. I appreciate your comments that, you know, I'm hoping these next couple bills we're going to be talking about that we don't talk about Green Acres for 40 years after this. So
you're telling me?
Yeah. So that's kind of my long-range goal, is that we get this right. And if the department has some concerns, you know, I'd like to be able to work with them on that. And so if you want to put this on hold for a couple days or till the next meeting, I...
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a couple things. Yes, there were some large changes in taxes that people hadn't anticipated. You know, a large part of that was probably that they were getting preferential tax treatment that they didn't qualify for. We had some assessor issues that were causing some problems. With regard to the questions about the university and whether they have to do a model here, they are currently doing a lot of this type of work with regard to rent payments and CRP payments. And what's the other stuff that they're working on, Senator Olsen? My memory is not as good here. But they do a lot of this work now, and they do publish graphs and charts. And in one of the meetings, we did have an opportunity to kind of review some of that stuff that they were doing. Now, I think the department is absolutely right in that we do not want to go away from a sales factor for considering value, because that's what we're based on. So what I was hoping for as we were working through this is that this would be information that they would be able to utilize, not to set the specific Green Acres, you know, values, but to assess the validity of the formula that they're using. And this is going to be something that isn't going to change tomorrow, because they're going to keep using the formula that they're using, but they're going to draw more information in and use that to assess if the formula is working as we want it to work, and then over time they would be making adjustments to the formula. And Mr. Hagan, I think, so, you know, that's the anticipation that I have from this discussion.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, that's exactly correct, and Representative Loeffler, that speaks to the concern we have with the language, because it is not prescriptive on the part of the UN. It's not going to be really a new model. It's more of a discussion base and look at different information and things they look at and try to do a safety check of the information we have now, make certain that the determinations and the assumptions we made are in fact correct, and where it's appropriate, tweak the values slightly and modify them. We certainly don't intend wide-scale changes. But as to your point about the effective date, certainly 2011 is coming real fast, and maybe a 2012 effective date might be a better solution. But again, these are not going to be wide-scale changes. They're going to be conversational discussions with the University of Minnesota where we just look at different options and different methods of arriving at value and different opinions without departing from the sales basis of the valuation.
Senator Skoy.
Yeah, thank you. And not to go on anymore, I think, Senator Rolstein, you need to do a little more work with the department, maybe you and Ms. Soth. If you recall, in committee, I had proposed an amendment, and that amendment is on line 9 of page 82, that you would convert the shall to may. That was just a proposal, but I would propose that if you're not making any luck with the rest of the discussions, you might want to revisit that thought.
So, Senator Skoy, and what I'm hearing Mr. Hagan say is that you would still use the same method that you currently are using, but some of these other things that Senator Osteen has mentioned would be used as kind of an outside guide to study, to look, to verify, and so forth. Do you need that in statute, or is that something you can do anyway, or should we? Is that something we should have in statute?
Mr. Chair, I technically we could certainly do that. It doesn't hurt to have it if we're going to have good, clear language and statute that really speaks to the issue. And certainly we could confer with the University of Minnesota on an ongoing basis, but if we could get the right language and statute, this would not be a bad thing. It would help to give more credibility, perhaps, to the valuation we come up with.
Well, Senator Skoy, Senator Osteen, I'm very interested, and I think the members here are too. Could you work on some language that would tighten things up a little bit, clarify some things, put the shell to the may, and have it with the same concept that we're talking about, where the current system would remain in place, but this would augment as far as verifying? Could you work on some things in the next few days?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
So thank you very much. Senator Skoy.
Representative Marquardt, I don't know where you were planning on going next with the discussions.
Senator Skoy, I've got about one or two more things, and I was thinking we would adjourn.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, what time is it? It's 10:40. Should we have a little discussion on the rural preserve covenants while Senator Rolstein is here?
Well, that would be fine.
Having some discussion.
I think that's fair. I mean, I will be up front that I am not in favor of making changes this year. But I think the discussion would be good. I just, you know, some of my feelings on this is, on the rural preserve, the first round of enrollment isn't even due until May 2nd of 2011. So, I mean, they're not even enrolling yet, and they have until January 2nd of 2013 to ultimately get it. And, you know, and the concern I also have is once you kind of set things and we change those, good or bad or otherwise, in farmers' minds, it's always going to be, okay, well, they'll maybe change it next year. And you never, ever get anyone to commit and to kind of get a mindset that this is what's going to occur. So I think it's fair that Sandra Olsen has worked so hard, and we can certainly listen to that, but I'm just going to be upfront that I'm not inclined to make much as far as changes in that area. So,
well, Representative Marquardt, to that point, there hasn't been any enrollments yet.
And correct. If
there is a time to make this adjustment and make it more conforming with other programs that we have, it would be good to do it earlier before people start to sign up, because then, you know, and I get your issue about making changes, and if you recall, I spoke quite loudly that I was tired of having green acres in the tax bill, but it's here. I think it's an issue, and I think there is some validity to having some discussion about it. So if we could have a little discussion, I think that would be good. Do you want to clean off your list first?
No, in fact, there's just one more thing, and it can be very, very quick. You know, and thank you, and then we will discuss Green Acres. The itemization of the special taxing district levies. Just let's, you know, we came back to that the other day, and we really hadn't kind of decided. Either we can kind of, you know, I was talking to the Department of Revenue today. They had some thoughts. I don't know, Senator Scott, I don't want to spend a lot of time with that, but it sounds like the percentage idea just isn't going to work. That would be kind of an administrative nightmare. And possibly there's a potential they could put all nine lines on there. It sounds like working that sheet, that would be possible. And maybe, you know, we could hold off a little bit, but I don't know if we could wanted to direct Department of Revenue to look at something, Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm in the somewhat uncomfortable position of not agreeing 100% with the tax chair who's not here. But my concern is we are reducing aides to our counties. We are reducing support to the counties in their health and human services area. We are asking a lot of our partners, and we are reducing our support to them. And do we really, really want them to go through the cumbersome, expensive, and now I see he's walking in, process of redoing their forms?
Yeah. Senator Rest.
We all did.
Oh,
I have
Senator Rest. We're all going to get F's, except you.
No. I got mine. I drove home.
Some of us are.
Madam Chair, in Hennepin County, they have the county and the city. And they list that state general tax, but of course I'm a homeowner. There's nothing on that line. So that's a burden. And then the school district, we have a referendum levy, so that's on there. And then other local levies, which I'm assuming is just the, I don't know what that is. And then there's one line for the Metro Special Taxing District.
Here's the 2010.
Oh, thank you.
And then it's just one line for them. And then there's one line for other special taxing districts. There's a line for fiscal disparities tax. There's a line for tax. And then there's a line for the solid waste tax, but it occurs on the property tax statement. And I mean, this is that's that, but this is
on
a statement. And how many more lines went on there? I think that's plenty.
Representative Loeffler, and we're not going to stay on this long. I mean, we can come back to this.
Well,
but
I thought of how I hadn't done my homework today, so I thought, well, I'll look it up on the web. And I have to say, this level of detail is not available on the web, because I thought that might be an option, too, rather than having to print it, that you could just have it available.
It's not there, though.
But it's not there, at least in my
tax statement. Not looking up the property tax statement.
Well, I'm going to ask
there's a whole bunch of them
Mr.
Here.
Nord, because we visited earlier, and your thoughts on what occurred the other night, and if you've been able to think about it since then.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I think, there isn't a lot of room on the tax statement, and anytime you're talking about adding lines, it can get really complicated really fast. And we talked to the different counties, and we hear things about where addresses have to appear for a window envelope, where perforations occur, how much size is needed for the stubs, and there are just a lot of very technical considerations to implement any change. We actually took a stab in the office of of trying to fit nine new lines on the tax statement, and we circulated it with some of the counties, and we're convinced that we need at least a delayed effective date to be able to pull it off. But we think there is a possibility of being able to add some lines, maybe all of them, maybe just a couple for some additional categories or something. But I think we're happy to look into the possibilities and work through them with the counties. And I think as long as we get a delayed effective date, we can try to make whatever you choose on a policy, from a policy perspective, we can try and make it work.
Very good. So, Representative Lincheski.
Mr. Chair, you know, just listening to Representative Rest, you know, it occurs to me, I really do think, now this is me, because if you've escrowed your property tax, if you're paying your property taxes into your mortgage, I think people actually, me, I look at the proposed, which is what Senator Rest brought in. And I guess that's what I've had in my head, not your property tax statement, your proposed. Because that's where you go, oh, this is what they're going to do to me. If I want to argue about that, I got to get down to the TNT. That's the one I always focus on. Do other people do that too? Or do you really look at, that's the one I focus on too, the proposed.
Well, Senator Scoy.
Well, I mean, my recollection of being on local boards is the proposed is the highest ones, and then they go through their TNT and do their adjustments, and the actual is generally a little bit lower.
A little bit lower, yeah.
So this is the biggest bite. So
well, but what do you think most Minnesotans look at?
Well, I know folks look at that proposed statement.
That's how I think of the line.
They looked at that. But, well, I think we have more.
Well, does anybody want to talk about how much it would cost the counties to do this?
Senator Scoy is talking about counties having to do this and the cost of doing this. I mean, I think there's a balance between transparency and cost, but I would always, if everything's equal, I would side on this with transparency. I just think you side with the public, which, of course, they're footing the bill, but the information. So, Senator Bach.
So, Mark Ward, how long have you been working on this?
We just actually started on this.
Anybody feel a need that we have to move either?
No, I thought maybe we'd come back, and I know I visited with Mr. Nord today. I kind of wanted him to give his comments on what they could or could not do. So let's come back to this at another time, unless someone wants to do something right now. But I do think it would be nice to at least be able to add a few more lines, so we can talk about that.
Oh, we did good.
We actually went through quite a list of here. Here's what we were getting near to adjournment, but since Senator Osteen is here, we thought to give him the privilege here of talking about Green Acres. Madam Chair, I did indicate to Senator Osteen, Senator Representative Lincheski, I did indicate to Senator Osteen our desire not to make changes to Green Acres, but I do think as hard as he worked, we need to give him the luxury of honor of giving us his
So, Mark, so we know who to target our effort on, or are there people that are on your side of the table that are interested in a little change that maybe we could...
There, maybe.
You know who a third person to work on between now and tomorrow might be?
I think Senator Osteen has worked on every one of them already quite a bit.
And brought friends.
Oh, good.
Tomorrow's Friday, so we want good time management.
Well, let's...
Mr. Senator Chair... when I was a county commissioner, I learned that all you need to do is count to three. So, but I appreciate the chance to actually sit at the table tonight. And on the rural preserve, this has become a huge issue. The senators have probably all heard this a number of times, but I've spoken to groups from Winona up to Foley. I've spoken to thousands of people in these groups where... to be polite, there's a lot of gray hair in the groups, and the average age of farmers in Minnesota is 59. The census is going to show that. That means half of these folks are over 59 and some considerably over. And there's just a reluctance on their part to sign up for this 10-year covenant. And in the discussions, a lot of them feel like that they were in the Green Acres program, and the legislative auditor had determined that now, after some of these folks had been in it since the inception of it, and so they're, you know, all of a sudden we've changed the rules on them, and in the, their interpretation is that a farm is a farm. You know, the back 40, it was the woods, it was a big, it was part of the farm just like the fields. And that were, so there's a big resistance to signing up for this 10-year covenant. And so having, like I said, having spoken to literally thousands of people on this, this brings about the amendment that I was able to, we were able to pass on the Senate floor, which strikes the 10-year covenant. Now, there still will be a conservation plan that people need to fill out to enter into the rural preserve, and there still is a 3-year payback, just like on Green Acres. The difference is that I believe by taking this out that people will just migrate their non-productive lands in by 2013 into the rural preserve, and they will be getting a tax benefit, but they'll be also keeping their land in a natural state. And the one thing that we had testimony on the Senate side was that a lot of these folks, you know, they're farmers, they have equipment, and they can make non-productive land productive land pretty easily. And I think our goal is, I mean, we just passed a tax amendment to try and preserve lands, and we already have these guys preserving lands under Green Acres, which they will no longer be able to do. But if they migrate those lands into the rural preserve, they will be able to maintain those lands. Because they say that they're getting hit double with this. Now, I would like to hear your response to what I'm just going to say, but that they're paying taxes on land that they're not getting any income from. It's different if they've got a field that's corn and beans and they're producing a revenue crop off of that. But if they've got 40 acres of woods that they're not pasturing, you know, they're paying taxes on that, but they're not getting any income. So this, we've already passed the rural preserve, so we are going to give them a tax benefit for preserving that land. This would just strike the 10-year covenant. So that's basically where we're at.
Well, it kind of goes back to, you know, the auditor's report is why we first started looking at this, because as Senator Skoy had said, there's 35 counties that either really didn't have to use it or just were not using it. And then, you know, as tax chair and so forth, we're looking at, you know, it's about a $35 million shift on other properties. And in fact, some of the townships that are the most impacted increases the property taxes on others, non-Green Acres, by about 32%. I mean, it's pretty significant. And, you know, and I hear that where they say the that you're changing the rules. But I would argue that, you know, the original rules weren't being followed. Now, and I'm not saying it was the farmer's fault. I think it was a lot of kind of assessor creep, if you will, where it was, okay, we're going to allow, okay, we'll allow, we'll, okay, you know, and it was, and I think it just because of the inconsistencies, you had people, quite frankly, getting a benefit on non-ag land that, you know, so yeah, so it wasn't grandfathered. I mean, you know, are you taking something away? Yes, they were getting the benefit, but they might not have deserved the benefit at a certain point. And so I think you could say did the ground shift or whichever way. But, yeah, and that's kind of the concerns. And so what we're trying to say here with the laws we made is, you know, we're going to allow you to continue to get this Green Acres benefit on non-ag land, but we're going to say you've got to at least commit 10 years on it. And I, you know, there's another program that commits you 8 years. I forget what the, you know, so I don't know how we came up with 10 necessarily, but that's I don't know. And so that's the kind of the problem is there is this sense that we shifted the rules, but, you know, from the initial intent of the law, I think there was just a lot of, you know, assessors and people tend to get a benefit that they maybe shouldn't. But Representative Erdahl.
I just wonder, Mr. Chairman, if, would it make any difference if it was changed to 5 to 7 years? Would that have any impact in your thinking?
Senator Ossini mentioned, you know,
well,
7 years.
Mr. Chair, I'm not a very good card player, but I did have an amendment in my pocket.
If you're not, don't say anything.
Okay. But I don't want to fold before I have to. Let me say that.
Senator Bach. I remember when we did these Green Acre provisions, there was some accusations it was done in the middle of the night, and I think there were some House members kind of mad at the Senate because kind of how it happened. And has this issue settled down over on the House side? We still seem to have a lot of people in the Senate that have got some angst over this. I mean, a number of our rural members still have some concerns about, I think the 10-year covenant was a House position. And
because they don't run for office.
I think Senator Olsen has got quite a bit of company over in the Senate that those changes went a little too far. Where we have other covenants, maybe we could have the department tell us where we have other covenants on land, what we have anything kind of this kind of duration, where we have other covenants on property.
Mr. Hagan?
I think there are a number of them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, there's two covenants I can think of. There's the SFIA program, which yields about basically $8 per acre back to the enrollees per year, and that is an 8-year covenant. I believe the Ag Preserve, which, again, I'm not real clear on, that's primarily a zoning classification, that, too, is an 8-year covenant. Those are the only two instances I can think of off the top of my head that require covenants outside of the Rural Preserve Program.
Well, there's another program.
Madam Chair, did we ever do anything with Blue Waters?
Oh, jeez.
That issue was around here for a long time. That had a...
That was
Senator Rest's bill. I'm just wondering, did we ever get that done?
Oh, Representative Abrams had that in his tax bill almost every year.
So we didn't. We didn't accomplish that.
Come back.
Yes. Yeah. Chair Lincheski.
I think it has calmed down in the Senate, but not with everybody, no doubt. But I mean, in the House.
Still our House members.
On the other hand, I think part of the issue is, you know, we were conferees on the, you know, redo. So, I mean, you know, do you think senators understand that there was the current law, which, you know, this, I mean, the old law, which this report was just, you know, damning. I mean, what a bad program. What a program without results, without preserving land, with, you know, some counties not even offering it, some giving it to everybody. I mean, really, this is one of the worst legislative reports there was. So that's...
Or best.
So do senators, do you think, know that it was terrible? Tax Conference Committee tried to fix it, and then last year, or whatever it was, almost all of it was undone. So we're kind of right back to almost the current law again. I mean, to the old law, to the old bad way. So, I mean, do you think the public and senators understand, you know, old way, in my opinion, fix, everyone freaks out, so we went back to here again. You know, we hardly have anything left. And, I mean, the way I view the covenant piece is, you know, you can't have it both ways. Your neighbors are paying your property taxes for you. And you don't want a covenant? I mean, to me, this just seems like the kind of the last remaining quality piece and most of what folks wanted to undo because people got complaints has been undone. So do you think senators understand that, you know, most of their concerns were addressed, or did they kind of miss that stage in that conference committee?
I think the problem, Madam Chair, with the public from talking to members who have Green Acres applicants in their district is, I think the people that were in Green Acres that had land that wasn't eligible think something was taken away from them. I don't think they realized they were receiving something they should have never gotten. And I think they're having a hard time, members that represent those areas are having a hard time communicating to their constituents that, well, you were actually getting something you were never really eligible for, that you shouldn't have gotten. And people think something's been taken away.
Like an entitlement now.
Yeah. Kind of the problem.
That was an entitlement.
I think Senator Olson, is that close to
it? Not entitled to it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment of it. And I think Representative Marquardt had some interesting comments, too, earlier. And but the big thing that I think that report addresses is that this Green Acres was for productive land, and people were getting a tax benefit not eligible for it. So then Senator Scoy leading the way, setting up this rural preserve that now people will be eligible for non-productive land and getting a tax benefit for it. And the one thing that I have to say is I hate that we call it non-productive land, because and the assessors call it wasteland, of course, and it's probably some of our most valuable lands for recharging our wetlands and our water systems. But it just boils down to, you know, I think that I've heard this comment so many times, that a farm was the farm. You know, now we have GIS and the assessor can pinpoint the thing down just to the square foot almost. And back when this program was the inception of it, that I don't think that was the concern. I think they just felt the farm was the farm, and that's where I think people are getting the angst, that now you're breaking my farm apart just because those are woods and that's wet.
We fix that. Mm-hmm. That's fixed.
Representative Coonan, do you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Quite frankly, I was hoping we were done. Senator Olson and Representative Eastland talked to me about this, and I can kind of see where they're coming from. I have to say, though, I wish we would have heard this in the House Tax Committees. That would have been interesting to get the full a view of what's going on and how that all interacts. Senator Olson and I talked a little bit about, shortening up the time required, lower that to 6-7 years, but then you run into the issue, too, that let's say you went to 6 years and with a 3-year payback, I don't know how many people would do that anyway, other than maybe for cash flow considerations, so I don't know how that plays into it either. Quite frankly, I'm still kind of pondering this yet, but I can understand Senator Olson's comments that if you got somebody that's 64 years old, for example, and then they have to sign a covenant for 10 years, how does that play into their estate planning and all of that type of thing? So I guess, to be frank with you, I wish we'd have had hearings on this so we could have, weighed everything out.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's the part that I'm still puzzling out, and I don't understand why the age of the farmer should make a difference on tax policy. We don't do that anything else other than the senior property tax deferral program, which is available to anyone who owns a homestead they've been in for 15 years anywhere in the state. And so I'm trying to understand, anyone who operates a business that's of advanced age has to make choices about whether they're willing to keep on doing it, or they're going to retire and they're going to try and get someone else to run it in the family or sell it on the open market or whatever. And I'm just trying to understand why this age thing affects this covenant, because the covenant is about an exchange for a tax preference. So maybe you could, someone who understands the program better than I think, could explain why the age of the people in this particular business should sway us on the length of the covenant.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, it's not, I agree that in law it shouldn't be, the age shouldn't be the factor, but it's the reality that in particularly in a lot of this area, the map that was shown earlier, you know, basically if you look around the St. Cloud area, north across the metro, down to Rochester and east to the river, that's primarily the lands we're talking about. And it's not, you know, section-to-section farming there. It's a 200-acre farm may only have 100 acres tillable. The topography of the land is such that, you know, it's not the full farm, and so half the farm may actually be, you know, and not non-productive land. Now, how does that play with the age? Well, a lot of these folks, you know, they've retired on the farm, and they're renting their land out, and the woods are, you know, that's a lot of their income is, you know, and it's not much, because if they're only getting $40 an acre from our earlier discussion, that's only $4,000 a year, you know. So, but in a lot of these couples, they're depending on that money, and they are at a point in their lives, and it's a lot of them in my district, and actually thousands that are getting this Green Acres benefit just in my area. They're not willing to commit to 10 years, and they have a lot of distrust in the government, period, because, you know, they've worked, a lot of them may have signed up for Green Acres, all of a sudden it changed on them. Well, maybe 40 years later it changed on them, but they're just kind of leery about, you know, what's going to happen in their own lives. You know, are they going to be around in 5 years, 10 years? They don't know that, and they don't like signing up for that. That's what's driving them not to sign up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, a lot of these individuals are, as Senator Olsen, you know, getting up close to their retirement years. But just want to walk back a little bit through what we did. You know, originally it was 3 years. And in the fix, where we really fixed all of this, it was seven, which was a pretty reasonable number, I thought. And so I think that there's some rationale for heading back toward that reasonable number that this conference committee fixed in our first go-around. But one of the things, there's more going on here than just the Green Acres Rural Preserve, because we did the 2A, 2B thing at the same time. And so land that probably was classified as wasteland, and really very little tax was being paid on it. It was part of their farm or whatever. Now is getting split off into this B, and then they're going to come out of their Green Acres and go into the Rural Preserve. So there's more stuff going on, and it is causing a significant amount of angst. And, you know, I think if we could just take a little kind of a step back from the thought about the developers and all of these people that we think might be parking land and taking advantage of this, and concentrate on some of these constituents that a number of our members have, we might think that taking a move toward that 7 years would be a pretty reasonable thing, because there have been a lot of changes that have occurred on these parcels of land in the last couple years, and it is causing some concerns and some angst out there, and you know, I think you got to take all of that into consideration when you're considering this.
Other comments?
Thank you. Mark Wirt, would you like us to move the Senate position, or would you like to talk more?
I think we'll need to think on that. Thank you.
Well, like I said, I
mean, I don't know if there's any more. Anyone? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while we're on the Rural Preserve, I only want to bring this up. But the department and Bowser have been having some discussions, and I don't think there's language, but I just want to make the committee aware that if we're able to, there are a couple of small word changes that we might like to have accomplished in the 8 criteria. And I don't know if you're ready to talk about it now or where we're at in that, but I know there has been some discussions. We were going to change the word plan to an assessment, And we were going to clarify that the field inventory, that we'd be able to utilize the NRCS USDA maps for that. The Board of Water Soil Resources is thinking it would make it a lot easier for them as they put these plans together. So I don't know if you want to go into it now or should we wait until we have this further discussion, but I just wanted the committee to be aware. I know that there's some work being done on that in the halls.
Well, Senator Scoy, would you want to add another bring some of that on paper?
Mr. Hagan, did you want to talk a little bit about this? I know you've been involved in some discussions, so
yeah,
wherever we're at.
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, certainly I'd be glad to talk about it. And we've sort of laid the framework and reminded ourselves what happened when the original 2008 language was passed as a result of the legislative auditor's concerns. And as Chair Lincheski pointed out, there was a lot of evidence in that report that there was a lot of things very flawed with the Green Acres prior to the changes. In 2008, a lot of changes were made. Part of the changes were there was a 7-year payback. 2B, they came up with the 2A and 2B land. 2B land would not qualify for Green Acres. And you perhaps recall all the testimony that resulted from that in the 2009 session. And a lot of the testimony talked about was farmers talking about how it was all one economic unit and they didn't want to split their farm out and they wanted to maintain the farm. And I think we all heard a lot of that in various committees and in natural resources and ag committees. As a result of that testimony, the Rural Preserve Program was born in 2009. And my memory of the conference committee and the hearings were the legislative intent was to keep the 2B land if the property owners were to enroll in the rural preserve and they would encumber the land with a covenant, that the expectation of them was to keep the land in its current condition. I believe that was legislative intent to not modify the land. Basically, I heard a lot and more recently about the expectation was to keep the land green as it was, continue that with the requirement that it be bound through the covenants so they could not develop it or sell it off. I'm not certain if it was how we got to the conservation management plan, but there's a requirement in the rural preserve that as a part of encumbering the land with the covenant, they had to embark on a conservation management plan. And there was some discussion about training that Bowser was going to provide and how soil and water conservation districts would be involved in this. Some of that hasn't worked out as it was envisioned at the time. Conservation management plan, I'm not certain if it morphed a little bit or if it was outside the realm of the legislative expectation or if just looking back, we thought we had different expectations or at least my memory of it. It's somehow the Keep It Green concept got into a bigger, more of a conservation-minded provision where they would have a conservation management plan. And here's where the problem sort of started to be encountered. Bowser was going to train the local soil and water conservation people to develop conservation management plans. Part of that conservation management plan requires the plan writer to go out, actually physically set foot and walk the property and do an inventory of the various types of trees and fauna on the property. Flora on the property and the fauna while they're at the same time. And what's the result of that was, I think it's well-intended, but the result of it is twofold. In some instances, it's raised the cost of the conservation management plan, which I think the legislature at the time was envisioning to be a small amount. And it's still not a huge amount, quite honestly. I think it's $200-$400 is the cost of a conservation management plan. I'm hearing a lot of farmers at some of the town hall meetings railing against that cost as being excessive. And you can have your own opinions about that. One soil and water conservation district said they absolutely were not going to write plans, and if people wanted to get enrolled in a rural preserve, they'd have to get a forest management plan, which is now a higher cost, too. Years ago, a few years back, the DNR used to provide those free of charge, and now because of cash flow issues, they require the property owner to pay for it, which is more like $500 or $600, I understand, as an average. The soil and water conservation district that said they didn't have enough staff to do conservation management plan suggested instead that maybe preferred language would be a conservation assessment. A conservation assessment in conjunction with a USDA aerial photo or a map, which would allow them to not have to go out and actually walk the land and not do an inventory of the different tree types that existed on the property. Instead, just the assessor, as we had envisioned, would draw out the land that is 2B, the forest, the conservation assessment would allow the soil and water to just identify those properties and identify good practices for it, not, which are currently in law. The only difference is the plan writer would not have to go out and actually walk the land and inventory the species, so it would reduce the cost and make it a lot more palatable to some of those farmers, and that's the suggestion, okay. I believe.
Yeah, I don't know if we envision to go out and see the flora.
Don't they have Google Earth out there? And just, you know, that's what we do in everybody's neighborhoods in the metro. Drive, you know, on your computer, you drive down the street, well, look in everyone's backyards.
Senator Skoy, could you,
can't you do that?
Put some language together?
And yeah.
We could, you know, we'd have to check with some folks, but.
Yeah, I'll work on that.
Well, you could use some software package.
Well, Madam Chair, they actually do fly and do aerial photos every year on this stuff. So we have the aerial photos, and that's what we want them to be using.
Oh, right, yeah. You just use some.
Yeah, that's, so that, if you could put some language together.
Okay, we'll do that.
Seems reasonable.
Madam Chair, I'm going to turn the gavel back to you, and we're, I think, done as far as I'm concerned, so whatever the time is for the.
Thank you for all the work. I guess we're going to adjourn. I think Senator Bach, you might want to tell us what he's talking about tomorrow.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious. I see there's a handout from the city of St. Charles here. I'm wondering, you know, my curiosity is Senator Murphy came to me today and asked me if I could find a way to take the House position on St. Charles. So I was wondering kind of how the discussion went.
Well, Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Buck, we did talk about this, and I did talk with the House conferees about how Senator Murphy had talked to us today about whether we would be able to make some progress. We did have some discussion that St. Charles, you know, wished to the legislature and made a request for monies for declining enrollment, and very little of that occurred, so they didn't utilize that money. And then they were here and had a request for a sales tax exemption for a building, and that didn't get rebuilt. And so we were kind of wondering if there would be a little more specifics of what this purpose of this was about. That's kind of where we ended this.
We decided to hold off.
So if the Senate moved the House position, would the House vote for their position? I'm just curious. We don't have to do it today. It would be. I do think maybe we could get. Does anybody here represent the city of St. Charles? Maybe we could get them to come in and tell us what. I remember reading in the paper that the business was not going to rebuild.
That's they're not right. going to. We should not bring them in.
Anybody here represent St. Charles?
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, we're logistically close to St. Charles. I know the city well. I know the people there well. I did suggest in an email a little while ago to their mayor that maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea if he were to come up here tomorrow, if we're going to meet. If that's, you know, if that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, I thought tomorrow would be local sales tax day.
And it might be already did that.
It might be a good time to have St. Charles come, as long as we've got some other cities here, just so that they could kind of talk to us about. I don't remember. It might have not been in committee the day that the Murphy bill was heard.
Should I get my amendment ready then for everybody to have a local sales tax in the whole state, not have to come here anymore? That'd be the good time to offer.
Is that the one with the local government aid offset?
That too, sure. Referendum, just kind of get it all, what it's for, get it ready. Or we could do without the local aid offset if you want to vote for it that way, but, you know, I think that'd be a good time, right? Bloomington can have
probably would be the everybody. Right. Probably would be the right day to do that.
And we can ask, look at all those mayors
trying
to ask them what they think about that.
Trying to be as courteous as I can to let the House conferees know what they should be prepared for. Because we do want to get through those. I mean, they're very personal provisions to members.
Yes.
They've been requested. In our case, we have the ones we have included had resolutions from the City Council, resolutions of support from the Chamber of Commerce. So there's pretty, you know, community support for them. So the members that represent those communities, we want to give them an opportunity to make their pitch.
Well, we've heard the pitch, but we'd love to hear it again. We've heard all the pitches many times. Right? We'd love to hear their pitches again.
We're getting closer.
We could actually make them for them. I think we know them so well. I could make the argument.
Then we'll try to think of a few other things to do tomorrow. But we should get through some work tomorrow because time is closing in on us. Mm-hmm. So tomorrow's what, Friday?
Friday.
And three?
11.
No, noon.
Later the better on our side. I think we go on the floor at noon, but then we just go to caucus so we can work. When are you guys on the floor?
Is anybody having a conflict to do it earlier than 10:30 if we did 10?
10. 10's fine.
Mark?
Well, you're not going to avoid the nighttime no matter what with him.
I'm not staying much longer. Or maybe I'll just die on the way home.
What?
Well, just Mr. Chair?
Madam Chair, go ahead.
You know, I do think it's a trade-off that a greater Minnesota members really give up a lot of time with their families. They really do because they're here. And Metro members worry about making it home alive 5 nights a week. So we just bought an hour home, and it's every night. So it's always, you know, both sides kind of have a bad deal here. So
we don't have homes to go to.
Right, I know. But I mean, you know, I know there's a state representative who I know very well who was actually pulled over because she was falling asleep behind the wheel, and the officer saw her and thankfully pulled her over, and she's okay. But that is something Metro members think about and deal with all the time.
I'm sure thinking
hey,
of...
Sleepy
I'll
are.
Try to stay awake thinking on the way to Kellyanne.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's my point. You don't get to see your family in the week, but then you're 5 minutes from home.
The comment of homes and not having homes to go to reminded me that we have another provision in the Senate bill that we'd like to talk about tomorrow.
This old house.
We will contact Senator Anderson and see if she can bring the advocates in for the provision in the Senate bill on the homeless and food shelf checkoff.
Mr. Chair.
We'd like to put that on the agenda for tomorrow also.
Hey, Mr. Chair, can I just tell you I watched that whole Senate hearing.
You have strong advocates.
It was
for
very
Senate
interesting to watch.
Conference.
Very interesting. Well, I think it was Senator Rest was for it. Senator Ortman.
Senator Langseth.
Senator Langseth. I was kind of wondering like what was passed out for water that day in the Senate Tax Committee. I was watching for something else, and it was just interesting to watch. Wasn't it an amendment on something completely unrelated?
It was, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman who just decided to throw it on there?
Madam Chair, it was the day we marked up the bill.
Yeah. Okay.
It was a very big deal.
Wasn't it Senator Ortman who was doing it?
Senator Ortman made the motion.
Uh-huh. We're very prepared for that.
Even though there are 9 Democrats on the Senate Tax Committee and only 4 Republicans, she prevailed.
Well, the Department of Revenue is getting ready with their forms presentation tomorrow.
I don't remember a lot of objection from their part.
Did you ask what they thought about it?
They thought they could squeeze a couple lines on.
Squeeze a few more lines.
I think they said there were states that
leaving.
There were states that had like as many as 9 of them, I think we heard.
And all it does is divvy up the same pot of money.
2 didn't seem all that difficult. And the Senate provision, Madam Chair, takes the cost out of the checkoff dollars.
You could
so there's
have
not a cost to the general fund.
Senator Bach, you could do the Vikings checkoff. Do you remember Governor Ventura had the Twins checkoff? That didn't go so well.
Madam Chair, I have a Vikings provision.
I know you do.
I have one,
try,
too.
Were you going to try to squeeze it in the checkoff?
Just been waiting for the nod.
Well, you know, everything else seems delusional. Local option sales tax. Anyway.
10 o'clock?
Yep.
Tomorrow, Morris?
We're done.
We're carrying the gavel.
Oh, you guys got the gavel.
We're
okay.
We're adjourned.
We're adjourned. Tomorrow morning, Friday.
Hey.
Should I talk to Hagen about it?